our three colored fellows there that was on the dock to help us sort out the rest of the stuff that we had in the cockpit. It was piled up, see. And I had all the shrimp down in the cabin of the boat there that we'd caught during the day and got separated out of it. We'd put them down in a big box down in the cabin where we didn't have room on the deck for nothing, see. So anyway, when we got through sorting out all the shrimp and everything, and I paid the three colored fellows off for sorting the shrimp out there, they got off of the boat and walked up through the fish house there, and when they got up there, they was carrying their boots in their hands, see. So the manager that run the fish house there, Bill Fager, this is the old man Bill Fager that was there originally, he told him, he said, turn them boots over there and dump them out, see. So they turned them over and dumped out a boot full of shrimp, see. Turned the other one over and dumped out a boot full of shrimp. I was right there, see. I told Bill, I said, that's all right, let them have those shrimp there. I said, they work pretty hard getting them out. So he said, okay, if it's all right with you, I don't care. But he said, I just don't want them stealing stuff on my dock, that's all. I said, well, they're not stealing them, I give them to them. So they took their shrimp and went on with them. Of course, they weren't worth very much anyway, 33 cents a pound, what we wound up getting for them. So anyway, my sister-in-law, she got out on the dock, and the ones that were heading the shrimp, they'd keep pushing the little shrimp into the pile of heads because they didn't want to head them. It was too hard to fill the bucket up with them, see. So she called the manager over and told him what was happening, you know, that they were pushing the small shrimp back into the head. So he told him, he said, don't push a head overboard. Not one more head goes overboard. And they didn't know why. But when they got all the shrimp headed off of the table there, he said, now go back through all them heads and get out all them small shrimp there and head them up, see. So they had to go back through all the heads there to get the shrimp, the small shrimp out, head them. So she saved me 150 pounds of shrimp there anyway that otherwise would have gone down the drain with the heads, see, because they were trying to fill their buckets quick, see. They didn't want to work that hard to get the small ones to fill the buckets. But anyway, when we got through, we had 750 pounds. But while we were sitting there with that pile of trash in the back of the boat with the shrimp and everything mixed in with it, the captain off of the Lou come over and he says, where in the hell did you catch all them shrimp? I said, man, right there where you seen me dragging, you drug right by me. He said, good God. He said, didn't you catch any fish? I said, look at my boat. It's filled up here with fish. I said, they're still there, see. He said, I don't mean that kind of fish. He said, I had 2,000 pounds of fish and didn't have but two shrimp. I said, well, I can't help it. I was in the dead body, I guess, because I did have 750 pounds of shrimp. And I was catching enough of shrimp each drag that I didn't have to quit and come in, you know. I was covering my fuel bill and making money, too. But that was one of my success stories, anyway, of having a net that I'd fouled up on. I'd made it with the wings the same size and everything else, top and bottom, you know. And the wings were scaring the fish up over the top of the net, but the shrimp wasn't making it. They were going back into the net. So when I found out where I'd made the mistake, I went and changed the net. I never had such a day as that again with it after I got it changed. You know, it was doing pretty good there for working in them fish, really. I think that'd make a good fish net nowadays. Have one made, you know, a good high net, but have the bottom of it to be the same position as the float line so that the shrimp would possibly go back into the net and the fish go over the top of it when the fish was that thick.
Do you still make nets?
I make nets, but I've never been to where I wanted to make another one like that, you know. After I learned how to make nets, I went ahead and made them the conventional way, and then when I experimented one season, I told Captain Fitzwater that was down here, I said, Captain Fitzwater, I'd like to make a new type net and try it out here and just see how it works. So he said, okay, I'm with you. He said, how much webbing do you want me to order for it? And I said, order me 1,200 meshes plus the bag and your chafing gear. So he ordered it, and I made his net, and I cut out the wings, and I cut them across the bar on the inside, and on the outside I put a 2-and-2 cut on the outside, which made extremely long corners on them and long wings. But he went out there that year, and that man caught the most shrimp that he had ever caught. So the next year, I had to bake everybody's nets. I had to bake all, we call them long wing balloon nets. See? Well, after that, then they started making them up in Fernandina, and probably had been making them up there before. I don't know. I don't know when they started them. So.
This what you're
But I just to? Lucked up on that one by just making this one as a semi-balloon net and a long wing. And they started calling them Jubilees. So when they started calling them Jubilees, well, I said, well, by old Jake Stowe, that's just a Jubilee net. That's all it is to it. So. But since then, I've made a net that was used years ago by Captain over at New Smyrna that made it, and his name was Joe Lucas, so they called his nets Joe Lucas net. So I started making a version of his net and putting a tongue in it in the place of the mongoose nets that are made up in Fernandina. Primarily they're made up there. Billy
Burbank
makes them up there. And his nets caught real good. There wasn't anything wrong that I could see with his nets at all, except that you had an awful lot of webbing in them, and they were very short wings. They didn't have very long wings on them at all. But I've learned years and years ago that the catching of your net is usually determined more so by the amount of mashes that you have in the body of the net as opposed to how many mashes you have in the wings of the net. The only thing is you get a little bit more spread with the long wing nets. They just spread out a little bit further, that's all. But with the long wing design that we're using on them now, and they're working real good. We haven't had any complaints on them, whatever. The only complaints I had, I went back to a 2-inch mass net we used to use in the old days. Their nets were as much as two and a quarter inch mass. And nowadays we're using heavier cord and they're using a smaller mash, which is 1 7/8. But the last two nets I made 2 inches. And we haven't used them yet. We're holding them for the season. We took them out and they tried them out, but on these brown shrimp, well, they don't want to work them. They'd rather work the brownie nets. So use a little bit smaller net. And it's not as high or anything else as these 2-inch nets. So of course, they're bigger as opposed to the smaller mash because they have the same amount of mashes, and it makes them a bigger net anyway by having that extra eighth of an inch on each mash all the way through the net.
What is a mash? Is that the...
A mash is, well, it's 4 knots. It's 2 rows of your webbing. It's be 2 rows of it. Makes up the complete mash. See, it's diamond shaped. And they use the 1 7/8 as a stretch mash. When the mash is stretched out, and when it's square, well, it'd be a fraction less than an inch. Mm-hmm. And they don't gill fish quite as bad because the real small fish that get gilled in it don't seem to attract the shark quite as bad, but they still eat them up pretty bad. When the sharks are bad, the nets get eaten, regardless of the small mash. So I wanted to try these out when the big shrimp are running in October and November on up through December, well up till December. After December, we get a run of small shrimp here, and they're really too small to be using a big mash net on. But the mash, the size of the mash don't make any difference because I caught 400 pounds of 200 count shrimp at the Cape on one drag in an hour and a half, 400 pounds of them. And it was just a total waste of shrimp. I caught 100 pounds of 21-25s with them. I guess it was the babysitters that was with them. But I just quit with them. After two drags, I said, if that's what I'm catching, I'm going to kill off the future population of the shrimp. So I just quit catching them, that's all. But we weren't getting much for them anyway. Back then, you know, people would almost be forced to have to drag. If they were catching them nowadays, you know, they'd almost be forced to have to catch them. Catching 100 pound of drag, well, that's a fair drag. Now, if you get 100 pound on a drag, that's a fair drag with two nets.
Has it been going down yearly?
Oh, yeah. It's been depreciating, and the price has been advancing. That's the only reason that people can stay in the business at all is on account of the increasing of the price on them all the time. And they're up to about, I guess, $660 now for off of the boat. And that's where they own the boat themselves. They're paying $660 for 1620s. And I guess some of the boats get a little more than that where they shop around before they sell them. I don't know, but that's been about the top price on them. I think they got up to $685 one time. But $660 is a heck of a price to pay for shrimp off of your old boat, I tell you. but it just indicates how the dollar value of them is going up, you know, and it's something that the demand exceeds the supply most of the time. They're having to import them all the time from Africa and South America and Honduras and all over the world. They're importing them. And of course, Japan imports them from here too. You know, I mean, they prefer the 10 and 12 count shrimp that they get up in Alaska to our shrimp down here. I mean, they catch them up there in traps. And they, as I understand it, they pay $25 a pound for them. So, man, there's no limit to the price on them if you can get a quantity of the shrimp enough to make it pay off.
Have you taught anybody else how to make nets in your family?
Well, you know, it's very hard to get a young person nowadays to get interested in it. They won't even stand and watch you for 15 minutes. You can try to interest them in it, but they won't pay any attention. They won't pay any attention at all. Even the boys that run the boats, they have no desire at all to learn anything about making a net. They just want to take them out there and drag them and talk to the other boats, you know, and see what they can do, and that's it. And whenever they get tore up, throw them on the beach and let somebody fix them up. So they don't even want to boat there. I mean, they'll mend them if they have to, you know, if they're strapped to where they can't tie another net on and go shrimping. They'll mend them then to get them back in shape where if they need them again, well, they can use them. Of course, they usually have enough nets on the boat, they can just change the nets and go ahead. But they don't want to do no more men. In fact, when the sharks are bad, man, you never heard such screaming in your life as they do about how bad the sharks are. They've never seen no sharks being bad. We used to go out there and we'd get out there and drag right up to dark around the inlet where the sharks were really vicious. And the sharks were so bad that when we'd catch them, they'd have bite marks all over them where the other sharks had bit them. You know, they'd been biting each other as they were feeding in the frenzies and by following the shrimp boats. And we'd get eat up so bad there when they were really vicious, and though it'd take us 3 days to mend the net up, we'd have three and four guys, or for some of the other boats, you know, would be helping us mend the nets up so we could get back out. You know, if we happened to have a bad case of the sharks eating them up, and in those days we stopped the boats and pulled the boat to the net, and when we pulled the net up, we were more or less just a sitting duck with the webbing kind of flopping around, and the fish would gill in them worse. Nowadays, they tow the net all the time, and it keeps the meshes stretched pretty well to where the fish don't seem to gill in it so bad. But when they gill in it, and on those times before a bad front coming through, a northern front coming down, you know, the sharks and stuff just seem to feed up more at that time than they would any other time when the wind is just starting to pick up, and just before the storm hits, they seem to sense that, and they just feed up. Everything just feeds up all the time. The sharks, the tarpon, the porpoise, and everything feed right around the boats. They're getting every bit of food they can to carry them through the rough spell where they won't have to forage for food during that time.
That's your
and people say that porpoise won't bite a hook. I've put a live fish on the line, and even dead fish, and put it on the hook, and throw it out, see porpoise come right up and take it in his mouth, and take off with it. You don't land them because they break your line, or they'll straighten your hook out, or something else, but don't say they won't bite it. They'll bite it on those days when those fronts are getting ready to come through, you know, and the barometer's falling. The porpoise will bite them just the same as, almost the same as any other fish will, because I've hooked 14 of them, I know that they'll bite them. And man, they ain't no holding them. I hooked one day. I took a 35-foot length of line and put a hook on it, put a live fish on it, threw it out, see the porpoise take it right in his mouth, and I had on a pair of gloves, and I set the hook with a hand line into the porpoise, and he took off with it, and he jerked it out of my hand. And just the minute that the pressure went off of it, he stopped. And the line just laid there, you know. I reached out, grabbed it again, and when I pulled it tight, he took off again and jerked it out of my hand, did that three times, come to the end of it, he just kept going with it, that's all. There wasn't nowhere to go after that, a 35-foot line. But man, they'd be right there in that clear water. You could see them there, you know, taking the bait. There was no doubt it wasn't the porpoise. They'd be right there, the old blowhole popping off where they were taking your fish.
How about your son? Has he picked up net making at all?
On what?
Has your son picked up net making at all?
No, he can make nets. I mean, he worked on them, and he can make them, but he you know, you hadn't done any of it. So yeah, it's something that you almost have to stay into it. You have to do it occasionally anyway. I only make them once a year now or something like that, you know, or repair them if they happen to tear some up or something like that. But other than that, why, you just have to know it, you know. And I mean, after you once learn the cutting of the webbing and stuff like that, well, there's not a great deal to it. I mean, you have a formula that you go by for making up the net, and it'll come out as near the same as you can get two nets to come out. But even then, one net might outfish the other one just a little bit on account of the way that it's tied onto the doors and the way the doors are operating on the boat, whether their doors are chained exactly the same or something else. Well, there might be a little bit of variation in the net, but usually they'll fish pretty close to the same. A lot of times you'll be dragging down a lane of shrimp with one net too, you know, on one side of the boat. Maybe the other net's just on the edge of them or something, so when it comes out, you have quite an uneven catch that time. But if it just happens once in a while, you don't really pay any attention to it. You go by your standard catch, usually, that you get out of.
Can a person make a living shrimping nowadays? A good living?
Well, they make good money, but of course the money isn't worth anything. That's the main problem. I mean, that the money is so inflated and all until you can't buy anything with it, like light bills at $160, stuff like that. You know, for home, it's unreasonable. That's all it is to it. I mean, it's just not even reasonable to be that way. But what are you going to do? They keep going up all the time. They never go down. I don't know. I don't know of any way that you could do any better except to use coal. We got plentiful. The coal is plentiful. Plenty of it. There's no reason why they couldn't use coal fired. And with all their modern techniques for burning it, there should be less sulfur in the air and everything else than there would be by burning oil, see. And I just can't see why they don't have more coal fired. And I suppose that it is going to be on the build until they get some of the, you know, solar energy or something like that to develop there before they're making electricity, because that's the only way they're going to be able to get it, as I can see it. Of course, they may become with some new type fuel, you know, that's been too expensive to use at all yet. It might come out and be the new going thing for it.
Are there other ways that shrimpers have adapted to the changing times?
They've adapted. The rigging keeps getting better every year. And they're using more powerful engines, and of course the fuel keeps getting higher and higher and higher all the time. But the price on the shrimp keep pace with it so that it doesn't hurt them so bad by what they can't do it. My nephew's boat down here, we haven't worked any of the area more than just from Cape Canaveral up to Jacksonville and back. And made a couple of trips to Georgia, just short runs up to Georgia there. But the boat is just about paying its way on the payments on the boat and the insurance and the upkeep of it and the dry docking and the cruise. They don't make any profit at all for the owner other than the fact that he's building up his inventory or his interest in the boat itself, as opposed to taking the collateral for himself. I mean, it pays the payments on the boat. And the only time that he has been in the hole at all was during the closed season when they couldn't do any shrimping. And that's pretty good because he has all the latest equipment on the boat. He's not putting an $11,000 ice maker on the boat at this time. And he has a cooler that cools the hole and keeps it down to 44 degrees all the time so the ice doesn't melt too fast, just enough to keep the shrimp in good shape. And they have every modern convenience on there, except I don't believe they have a microwave oven on it yet. They have the TV and all the rest of the stuff, the air conditioning in the cabin, and just as nice as you could have and still be at sea, that's all.
This was kind of a rough time when you were a young man shrimping.
Well, back when we were going out, we'd get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and be out there by just about daylight. We'd put our nets over at daylight and drag until it got dark. When the sun got down to the last 15 minutes, we'd jerk our nets in and run for the dock, and it'd be sometimes 11, 12, 1, and 2 o'clock in the morning before we'd have our shrimp headed out and weighed in, because, man, you come in with 1,000 pounds of shrimp, you got a lot of shrimp. I mean, these boys, nowadays, they head up a couple of 100 pounds a day, and that's the extent of it. I mean, they got 3 men on the stern deck on a lot of them, 2 men on some of them. And very seldom they ever run it with one man. And back in the old days there, some of them, they'd have a good fast man on the deck. One man would run it, but of course if he got sick or something, then they'd have to hire somebody else to take his place, or 2 people to take his place while he was healing up, see, and getting ready to go back out again. But it's better this way, you know, if there's 2 or 3 of them, where they can get a little rest period in between, and their hands never get sore anyway, because they don't handle that much stuff. They might get sore from putting their hand on a catfish, or having a shrimp snap them when they take him out of the trinet or something like that. You know, he might snap them and cause them to get a mild infection or something from it. But most of them take a tetanus shot or something for that purpose anyway, where they don't usually get fish poisoning from it. I've seen them, though, with fish poisoning in their big toes, everything else, you know. I mean, it's a bad thing, man. I mean, it's really vicious. They have to go to skin specialists and get special shots, and some of them are taking these antibiotics now, pill form that they take for them, and it seems to knock it out pretty good, about as good as anything they can take for it, I guess.
Well, that's great.
But it's something that it gets into your blood, you love it, and there's so many different directions that you can go in it, you know. I mean, in the net making, and the fishing of the boats, and the upkeep of the boats, and the dry docking them, and everything that goes with it. I mean, the fishing offshore for red snapper when the shrimp are not running too good. Well, we used to take this boat out, go out there. We caught as much as 6,500 pounds of fish out there on a 3- and 4-day trip. So it works out pretty good. I mean, most of the boats if you talk to them, or they never made anything. I never seen a boat yet that was really making a lot of money when you talk to them, but you're just barely staying above water, and that's just about all there was to it, you know. But actually, when you figure the statistics on how many shrimp is brought in, they catch a lot of shrimp over the whole coast, you know, this coast and the Gulf and Texas and down to South America and all over, like they drag. Of course, the boats that are here, most of them don't go to Africa and stuff like that. The Africans themselves hire people over here to bring the boats over to them sometimes, or run them over to them, you know, and then work on the boats after they get over there till they get their crews to where they know all about the boat and everything like that, and they turn them over to their regular crews over there and send the Americans back home. And so it works out pretty good. I mean, we've got boys that was raised up right here now that are going to Egypt and all over on these oil supply boats, you know, where they're working the deep water over there with the oil wells and stuff like that. They're needing them over there now, and some of them got some doggone good jobs out of them.
How many men did it take to have to crew it? Say a 30-foot shrimp boat back in your time?
Well, it was just 2 or 3 of us. Usually I took 2 with me, because I had an angina condition from the time I was 52 years old, and I just couldn't do it. I mean, man, I was in worse shape then than I am now. I'm 72 and a half now, but I just absolutely could not do the work that had to be done on the deck of the boat. That's all there was to it. So I had to take 2 men with me and let them run the deck, and I run the boat. Hush up, Dolly. I hope that's sufficient.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me.
Well,
I really appreciate it.
I hate to get wound up like that and not get some of your insight on it, of what you picked up, you know, around where you've been trying to gather some information on it. But we've been using the turtle ejectors for the last 2 years, and we found them very satisfactory. They get rid of the turtles, they get rid of the jelly balls, they get rid of all the rays, if you have, except your manta rays. They're the only thing that won't go back into them.
And this is something you designed, this turtle ejector?
Oh, no, I didn't design that. That was designed and used over in Oregon 10 or 12 years ago. Uh-huh. And they said that some of the boats over there were using them and some of them wasn't. And it's the same way over here. Some of them are using them and some of them won't. But the ones that are using them are saving fuel, because they don't have to lug all that heavy stuff like sharks and rays and jelly balls and and other heavy stuff that gets in your net. I mean, it just piles up in the bag, and you got to, everything that you put in that bag, if it's a ton or 2 tons or whatever, and you're pulling it through the water, it's costing you fuel, you know, to do it.
What, why do they call them turtle ejectors?
Because they eject every turtle that gets into it, unless he's so little he goes between the bars, goes back into the bag. See, they have bars on them that close enough together that jelly balls will roll up those bars and go on out of it. When it piles up against the gate, it opens and lets them out. And on the ones that we use, we put a piece of bungee on them to hold the door shut when there's no real pressure on it. When it gets a bunch of jelly balls or a turtle or anything against it, or a fair-sized shark or anything like that, why, you just go right on out of it. And we've caught as many as 4 and 5 ton of rays in our nets at times out there, you know, and they just bust your nets. There's so doggone many of them. Of course, with the nylon, they'll pick up most anything that you get in them nowadays, but there's times that you just get so doggone many, you have to cut the net and dump them out. That's all there is to it.
Does it kill them when you get them?
The rays and
yeah.
stuff, it kills everything that comes in on the boat, you know, but
right.
if it stays there long enough, why, it's so debilitated until it just dies, that's all. And the sharks, they come in drowned. I mean, the turtles come in drowned. Mm-hmm. And with the turtle ejector, he goes right on out, so he never knows he was even in traps. See, I mean, he goes right on out of the turtle ejector before he ever gets to the bag. He's not crowded, he doesn't get suffocated or anything else. It's going to be a great thing for the turtles if they can get the boats to properly use them, you know, where they, if they realize the amount of fuel that they burn over a period of a year, you know, hauling that junk around out there, and on top of that, keeping their nets from fishing good because it's piling the net up with stuff that you don't have no market value for. It just isn't right to kill off the turtles and stuff like that anyway if you're not going to use it, because eventually they're using sharks now, you know, and as fish, as food for people, you know, and it's not fish, but at the same time it's a seafood, and it's a doggone good seafood too. I've eaten it and I like it, and it tastes just as good as any seafood that I've ever had. But there's certain sharks that you can't use. Some of them are too strong and they don't cook up good. But the ones that they serve in the school lunchrooms and stuff have the same protein value in them that the rest of the seafood or fish has. It's really good. I mean, and they can buy it cheaper. They can buy it for, well, I don't know what they're paying for it now, but at one time there, they were getting it prepared ready for frying for about 79 cents a pound. Well, they couldn't beat that nowhere in the world for getting good protein nowadays, you know, but it's just as good as anything they could have served. I'll guarantee that, because I've had it myself, you know, that was fixed up right practically before my eyes down there at Inlet Harbor when I was running out of there. The owner of it brought some over to us one day, and he said, "Here, I want you to try this. See how you like it, see?" I tried it. I said, "Man, that's good. Give me some more of that." And so then I thought he might be kidding us. I thought he might have had a cobia or some other type of fish. So when we went shrimping the next day, we caught a shark. We put a line out, caught a shark, cut out about a 10-pound slab out of him, and brought him back in all ready for the restaurant. We took it over and had him fried up right in there, deep fried, just like he had. And I'm telling you, the lady that run the restaurant, Lee Thomas, she said, "I'm telling you, if there's any way in the world I could put that on the menu, anything except shark," she says, "shark scares people away. They don't want to eat it." But she said, "it's just as good a fish as I've ever ate." And she said, "I know it'd go over big here if we could just put it on the menu as something besides shark." And I guess nowadays, I've seen it in restaurants nowadays. I see it in there several times. And Southern Fishermen says they're selling it all over the country, you know, and they're just developing a market on it. If people find out it's good, well, they won't be afraid to try it, you know. But most people get the idea, well, that shark eat me. Well, that's their way of getting even with him. Eat a shark.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Stone. Really appreciate you taking the time to talk.
Okay.
I really enjoyed it.
I run this boat here for a year and a half after we got it. I turned it into my grandson running it now.
It's a shrimping boat?
He's doing pretty good. He's got him a home computer, and he puts everything down on the computer. Recall, you know, where he can get it back at a touch of the finger, you know. It's real good. I mean, it's something that we never had except just remembering what we had done.
Well, what I wanted to talk to you about was old-time shrimp traditions
Ponce. Back in 47, 48, right after World War II there, while we were using converted charter boats for shrimp, and we didn't even have regular shrimp boats at that time. And there was a lot more shrimp, so we caught more shrimp then than we do now. And the only difference was the price in them. You know, we sold shrimp for 33 cents a pound back then for 21.25. That's the biggest shrimp that we got paid for anyway. We might have had bigger shrimp than that. A lot of times we'd throw them all together and they'd go in as 21.25, so there had to be bigger shrimp in amongst them. And it wasn't unusual for us to go out there. If we didn't catch 50 pounds, we'd turn around and come back in because there wasn't no shrimp there that day. We wasn't getting much for them and we couldn't afford to stay. But actually, the fuel was so cheap, we were only paying about 18 to 20 cents a gallon of fuel, and that was gasoline. And the first shrimp boat that I ran was a Jim Dozier. I ran it for a fellow by the name of Peter Polis. He was a Greek in Daytona that had this about a 49-foot shrimp boat, and that was the first actual shrimp boat that I ran. And I would say that the average catch on it for drag was about 100 pounds with one net. We only used one net in those days. Nowadays, they pull two nets just as big as the ones we pulled on the smaller boats back then. I remember one trip in particular, we were going out to go snapper fishing one night, and we were just going to make a drag to catch bait. And I had my nephew, Frank Timmons, with me, and my son, and one other fella. And my son, he was at the wheel running the boat while we were dragging for bait, and he was reading a joke book while he was steering the boat. And we were making up A-frames, getting ready for the commercial fishing offshore that we were going to do the next day. And after an hour and a half, we decided, well, we got enough of bait, so we'll just pull the net in. We pulled the net in, got it up to the side of the boat, almost had to block and tackle it up to get it up to the side of the boat. So I tried to lift it onto the boat, and it was about to pull the boat under. I told my nephew, Captain Frank Timmons, I told him, I said, go back there and see whether that's shrimp in that net or whether it's fish. I said, I don't want to pull on it too hard if it's shrimp, because we might lose them. See, in those days we used cotton bags and they wouldn't lift them. You know, maybe a couple of thousand pounds they'd lift all that. But it was a strain on everything. So we pulled it net up there where he could look at it, and he got back there and he said, oh no, it's just fish, Uncle Jake, go ahead and pull her in. So I took another couple of turns on the dig ahead and pulled it on up, and when I did, the net come over the side of the boat, it tore five of the rings off of the bottom of the net and spilled out 850 pounds of big shrimp right in the boat after we got them headed out. That was what we had, 850 pounds. And so then we made another drag after that. Of course, my son, he didn't know where we was at. He'd been reading that joke book while he was running the boat. The rest of us was busy, wasn't paying no attention where we went. So we made the next drag for an hour and a half, too, and we had about 50 pounds, I guess, that time. We missed the main body completely. So then we made a third drag, and we had 100 pounds on the last drag. So then we decided, well, we got everything. We had the whole cockpit just piled up with shrimp there. So we had plenty of ice. We had about 3,000 pounds of ice on board the boat to go fishing with. So we just took the ice and piled it all over the top of the pile of shrimp about 6 inches deep all over it and spread a tarp over the shrimp for that night, about 11:30, I guess, when we turned in. Got up the next morning. The wind was blowing about 35 or 40 miles an hour. There wasn't no chance of going fishing. So apparently that was the reason the shrimp were schooled up the night before the blows. So we cranked up, come on back to the dock, and headed shrimp all day long. When we got them headed out, we had 997 pounds of shrimp for those three dregs that night. Another time I was down at the Cape with a smaller boat that I had. This was before the other one. And we were dragging out there, and a friend of mine over at New Smyrna, Anchor Damgard, he also ran a shrimp boat. He and his wife was running it. And he made a 40-minute tow right in amongst the other shrimp boats. And when he pulled the net up, he had 90 bushels of shrimp in that 160-foot net that he had on towing the boat, with the boat. And all the other shrimp boats, big shrimp boats that were down there from St. Augustine, when they'd pull their nets in, they would only be dragging for 30 minutes or so, and they'd have some of them that had 50 bushels of shrimp in 30-minute tows. So he took his load of shrimp and went into the Cape and tried to sell them there, and they said, man, we don't want no shrimp. They had 400 bushels of shrimp there on their shrimp tables anyway, working all night, they're heading the shrimp out. So he said, well, let me have some ice then. I need ice to ice these shrimp down. They said, we can't even let you have no ice. You just go out to make a run for it. It was, the storm was coming up, see, the hurricane was getting nasty at that time. There was a hurricane coming. So he made a dash for New Smyrna anyway, and he said he almost made it before he started capping seas over the bow of the boat, but he got in New Smyrna with about the skin of his teeth, and of course he had 28 bushels of shrimp that he caught before he got the 90 bushel, so he really had a nice catch of shrimp. But those are days gone by. The biggest catch of shrimp that I've heard in recent years was caught down at the Cape. I don't even remember the boat that got him. But he made a drag there with his twin net rig, you know, regular super shrimp boat like they have nowadays, big rig. And as the best I could get the story on it was that he caught 66 boxes of shrimp in the one drag. And that was more than the 90 bushel that Anchor had, because his was figured on the basis of the heads on shrimp, where this fellow got 66 boxes headed shrimp, see, for the one drag. One fella dragging right side of him only had 12 boxes, so he was in of it, the other boat was out of him. That was the difference.
What's happened to the shrimp industry?
Well, this one company that built the shrimp boat that my partner in a partnership business bought from Diesel Engine Sales at Desco in St. Augustine. They built 527 boats there before that one was built. That was the 527th boat that they had turned out there. And since then, they've turned out over 2,000 or 3,000. I mean, I remember when it was up around 22,000 that they turned out. They've been selling them foreign and domestic all over. So there's just so many boats and so much better equipment been used, and they shrimp them day and night a lot of times. They're not supposed to, you know, during the season. They're supposed to shrimp them during the daytime mainly. They do have times that they open up the night shrimping so that you can shrimp day or night. But it's just seasonal. And they don't give the shrimp a chance to escape. I mean, by the time they work them all the way down the coast from North Carolina to the dry Tortugas grounds down on Key West, they've pretty well cleaned up the run of shrimp for that fall that was coming south. So apparently the shrimp come out of the rivers all the way up, possibly to New York Harbor and Boston and right on up there, because they catch small shrimp up there like they do over in Coos Bay, Oregon, and up in Alaska. Of course, their shrimp up there is a different type of shrimp. They never get big, the ones they have in Alaska, don't they? They're a very small species. But they catch them in great quantities. I was up there 12 years ago in one of the boats out the day that I went out king crabbing up there. He told his friend, he said, I had 10. And his friend said, what'd you have, 10 shrimp in your dry net or 10,000 in the big ones? So he said, 10,000 in the big ones. Caught 10,000 pounds on one drag there, see those small shrimp. And they bring them in and just pump them into the factory there out of the shrimp hole. They flood the hole and pump them right into the factory and they process them by machine, because they're too small to process by hand. It'd be impossible to do anything with them. that.
Do you come from a shrimping family?
Not necessarily. My dad was a railroad engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And I started out with a little 26-footer, and I shrimped it every fall. I'd shrimp it back in 48 and 49 and 50. And then I took over this other shrimp boat and run it 50 just during the one season there, the Jim Dozier. Then I ran the Mariner for about 2 or 3 months, just a short time, and I went back on my own small boat. And then when I bought the Mako, which was in 52 or 53, I bought it and I converted it every fall. And all the party boats would convert over for shrimping. It'd take us about a week to convert the boats over. We had them quick change or they thought about switch them over for shrimping from party fishing or commercial fishing, whatever the season was. Well, that's what we done with them. See, to be versatile and be able to make it through to the next party season. See, at that time, the parties weren't consistent like they are now, where you can run a party boat year in and year out. But our shrimping out there, I'm telling you, we had the shrimp. There was no doubt about that. And the weather'd get rough out here, and sometimes the St. Augustine boats would be down here before we'd even get a chance to get out. It'd be, our barrel didn't have the jetties like they have now. And it'd be so rough until it was actually taking your life in your hands to cross the bar there when it was really nasty. So they'd beat us out there sometime, but most of the time we'd get out maybe a day ahead of them. And usually, boy, you could count 100 boats out here a lot of days shrimping. They'd go into New Smyrna, you know, whenever they were either unloading or just had to go in to get some supplies. They'd go into New Smyrna and they'd be docked there 10 deep into the docks. You know, they'd have to go over 10 boats to get to the dock. There'd be so many of them tied up side by side there. And they'd be, when the wind would blow and it'd get too rough for them out there, sometimes there'd be 100 boats in New Smyrna over there. It was a real nice industry for the town there. But the shrimping got now to where it's more or less just scratching all up and down the coast. And the boats, they, some of them come over here from Texas and New Orleans and over in there, come over here for the fall run of shrimp that come down the beach. And usually by January or February at the latest, while they've usually gone on down to the dry Tortugas grounds or on and back over to Louisiana and crossed over on the Gulf Coast and over to Texas. But they follow the shrimp wherever they get on. Those radios that they have will reach 2,000 miles. Now they can keep in touch with where the shrimp are being caught at all times. And they use codes so nobody knows except their friends what they're getting, you know. But it's a great life. I enjoyed every minute, I guess, that I ever put in shrimping. But I used to think in the old days there that if rather than putting people in jail, they ought to sentence them to a month in the shrimp pit out there heading the shrimp, because I've actually seen the men head shrimp till the blood would be dripping out of their gloves, the gloves that they wore to keep the shrimp from cutting their skin on their hands. The blood would be dripping out of the gloves and they'd just work right on it, just above and beyond the call of duty. That was the way they'd work. I don't see how they could do it. Their hands would get so sore and they'd have to take a week off and go to the doctor and take tetanus shots and everything else to keep their hands from being completely ruined, you know, because they were already so sore they couldn't work with it. But man, it was, they were just by the quantity of shrimp. We'd go out there day after day and catch 700 or 800 pounds of shrimp a lot of times. You know, nowadays you get a box and a half or 2 boxes, and they'll stay right there and drag them every day right after that, thinking that, you know, well, this is better than it might be somewhere else, you know. And of course, you never can tell about that. That's something you just have to do. It's hindsight, all of it, as to what you're catching, except when you hear some other boat getting them, you know, they're giving you the straight scoop so you can go get them. Yeah. A lot of times that happens, too. I mean, the shrimp, when they get scrappy, everybody wants to check with everybody else all over. And when they get quiet, that's usually when they're catching shrimp.
Do you have sons or family that
Yeah, my
in
son,
business?
Though. He isn't shrimping now. He's running the Sea Critter. Him and Paul Nelson operate the Sea Critter and a Super Critter, and they change about one on the other boat. When they only have one party, while one of them gets a day off, That's the only way to get a day off, actually, with a party, you know, during the busy party season.
Was he a shrimper?
Oh, yeah, he shrimped with me. He's been out there when it was so rough, and he'd have to tie himself on the deck of the old Desco boat that we bought back in those days, which was would have been a fine shrimp boat today. You could have put stabilizers on it, but stabilizers hadn't even been thought of at that time. We didn't know anything about it. But it's just a great thing now. They use every boat pretty near has a set of stabilizers on it, whether they use them or not, because it takes out about 50% of the roll, and that's about, you know, it makes it where it doesn't tire you out so bad on the boat.
Were you a superstitious shrimper?
Every fisherman is superstitious. I remember one time back, this is off the subject of shrimp there, but one time back during Prohibition days there when a whiskey boat come in about 9 or 10 o'clock on Friday the 13th. The crew on the boat was so superstitious, they just knew they were going to be caught. That's all there was to it. And they pulled in the post office dock down here. At that time, the mail came over to Ponce Inlet here from New Smyrna by mail boat, you see. So they pulled in there, and my mother was renting boats at the time, so they rented, I think it was four of the rowboats that we had there, and tied them one behind the other behind this loaded liquor boat, and took off up the river, up and went through the Port Orange Bridge about 10 o'clock on Friday the 13th, and went on up to a place just north of the Port Orange Bridge there that was an old unloading spot there anyway for the whiskey boats. But they didn't do it in the daytime. They usually went up there at night and unloaded them. This time it was broad open daylight on Friday the 13th. And we pulled in there and we unloaded all the whiskey off of the boat. I believe it had about 300 cases on it. And we hauled it in there. It had about 9 automobiles hauling it off as fast as we can unload it. And we got back out of there, though, and come on back down to the dock and put our rowboats off and hid the boat up in the creeks. And it was just a great, great day. I mean, nobody had any problems at all. They got away with all the whiskey and everything else. And on Friday the 13th, the crew was scared to death because of their superstition about being Friday the 13th. But out there fishing, the first captain that I ever went out with here to go commercial fishing, we'd been shrimping. We'd gone out. It was on a shrimp boat, but we used them as combination snapper boats and shrimp fishing in those days. So we went to Ormond, fished for 3 days up there, and we had about 2,000 pounds of shrimp that we caught up there in the 3 days we were up there, which was real good shrimping, but we were only getting 25 cents a pound or something at that time for them, because that was the first trip I went out, and I know they had got up to 33 cents at that time. So we went snapper fishing, and we spent 3 days in out there. Well, we caught 850 pounds of red snapper and 1,780 pounds of rock bass, and we had about 500 pounds of trash fish, porgies and trigger fish and stuff like that with them. And so we come on back in New Smyrna, and the old captain that I was with, he was rather superstitious. He wouldn't allow us to turn a hatch upside down. That was supposed to be really bad luck. That was something that just, your trip wouldn't be successful if you turned the hatch over. And he went barefooted as a yard dog. It'd be 32 degree weather. He'd be out there barefooted walking around that deck because he felt safer and more sure-footed if he was barefooted than he would if he had his shoes on, see. But we come on back, and I think I made about maybe 5 or 6 trips with him. And the owner of the boat, he told me, he said, I'd like for you to go fishing with this captain. He said, he is kind of chronic and hard to get along with and all that. He said, don't try to tell him how he can improve things on the boat. But he said, I know that you're mechanically inclined. And he said, he's got an old can hanging down there with a stick in it, with a hole in the bottom of the can, and he pours it full of oil, and he's got it hanging up over this bearing on the shaft, dripping the oil onto that bearing on the shaft, see? And he said if he wants a little more oil, he loosens that stick and lets the oil drip a little faster, see? And he said, I'd like for you to just suggest to him that he could put a grease cup on there or an oil cup or something that would do the job, and it just wouldn't be a sloppy job like his homemade rig is. So a couple of days later, after we got back in, I was talking with my friend, and he said, was you able to get the story across to him about that old oil can that he got hanging up there dripping on the bearing, on the drive shaft bearing? And I said, yeah, Bill, but I said, you know, that's the most unique thing that you've ever seen in your life, and it works. And I said, I'd be silly to tell him to put something on there that was made by some machine shop somewhere, Precision and everything else, that probably wouldn't work a doggone bit better than what he's got there because his bearings lasted for years like that. He said, well, I guess you're right. We'll just leave it as it is. But it just one of those little unique things, you know, that happen along the way, and you just pass them over, that's all, because it wasn't anything I could have done. It would have improved it. It was working. It was satisfactory. And he wouldn't have been receptive to it anyway. But he was chronic in the way that I was out there for my first trip, and we were coming back in, and when I first picked up the lighthouse, you know, got sight of the lighthouse, that was my first time of being out of sight of it and went offshore. I said, oh, boy, I said, that's real navigation. I said, there's the lighthouse right over the bow, see? And he said, well, it hasn't moved any. Lord, yeah. I think about those things, you know, just a little mix like that that come out of it, you know, that just stick in your mind and that it stays with you for the rest of your life. But he was a remarkable fisherman. But I also fished with old Ralph Wetherill. He was considered one of the best snapper fishermen on the coast here. He'd go out and he would pound with a sounding line, an old lead sounding line, looking for snapper. Some days he'd look all day long and wouldn't find any fish at all. But he was so good at it, and sometime during the trip out there, the three-day trip, well, he'd hit a school of snapper, and we'd catch enough of fish to come in to have a real payload out of it. It might not be snapper. We might have just had a few snapper along with the sea bass and the grouper and other fish that we caught, but there was a payload there that we'd get paid off every time we come in pretty good. He was one of the best. And one day we were out there, we were catching snapper real good. That old Gator Pierce come up. He was the one off the shrimp boat with a can dripping the oil on the shafts. He come up there. He was running the memory at that time from the city dock in Daytona Beach. And he come up there and shut his engine off upwind from us and let the boat drift down till he got to where we was at. When he got down where he could talk to us, he said, my compass has gone out on me. He said, I don't know where I'm at. Can you tell me where I'm at? And he knew where he was at. He wasn't kidding nobody. The captain told him where he was at, though. He said, we're out on the East 11 right here. He said, I'm sure after you start fishing here, you'll know where you're at. See? And he did, too. He knew where he was at. He was a doggone good fisherman, but he just used that as an excuse to get the fish with us without making it look like he was following us around out there. See.
Did you ever use any of those tricks yourself to get into a...
Well, I...
Everybody does, I guess, don't they?
Well, not necessarily. If I went out there and somebody was fishing, I'd go right up to them and I'd talk to them. And if they were doing any good, well, I'd stay and fish in the vicinity, you know. I never tried to crowd them or anything like that, but I'd fish in the vicinity of them. And they did it with me. I mean, it was just one of those things. The ocean's supposed to be free, and you just go there and fish, that's all. And I remember one time there when I first put electric reels on my boat, I had an angina heart condition, and I wasn't able to reel them up with the old hand cranks. I'd just give out on them. I couldn't reel them up, so... I put the electric reel on for myself, you know, for my angina condition. And we were fishing up northeast of the bar here, up on what's called the West Side 21 up there. And we were catching snapper and catching them pretty doggone good, too. But a Mako shark came by, a big Mako shark came by, and every fish that the boys on the hand reel had hooked the shark would get it, see. And every one I hooked with an electric reel, I'd pull them right on by them, and the shark would be down, and he'd go like that, you know. He'd follow that fish like that, and I'd have him in the boat before he could get him, see, with that electric reel. And these other boys would lose every one that they got. And of course, the shark didn't come around till after we'd caught quite a nice catch of a snapper. And when the shark would go over and molest the other boats, well, then we'd be pulling them steady. See, all three of us would be pulling them in. And they'd go over there, and they couldn't get a fish in. They were all fishing with hand reels, and hand crank reels. So when I come back in, I put two more electric reels on my boat. I said, the heck with that. If I can pull them by the sharks, I know them other boys can too, see. So it wasn't very long before every boat was equipped with electric reels down here, because it was just a better way of doing it, and the sharks didn't really give you that much problem with it. You still lose one once in a while. When you get a big fish, he'll fight you till the shark gets him. But a lot of times, well, you can just pull them right on by them, and they don't have a chance at it.
How did you get into net making?
Well, the net making just evolved naturally down there, because I used to wonder how in the world that they could make nets the way they did it in St. Augustine. I couldn't even mend one. Of course, I was just a kid then. I was about 15, 16 years old. And I started mending beach seines. And then when I started with the shrimp nets, well, I started mending the shrimp nets on the first shrimper that I run, and on my own boat when I was dragging my own nets out there. So I just decided after a while, I said, well, I'm going to find out how to make these nets. So I went over, and this anchor dam guard that I was telling you about to cut the 90 bushel drag down at the Cape, I had him make me up two nets, one and a spare net, see. And at the time, he was making flat nets, and he told me the difference between the flat nets and the balloon nets and stuff like that while we were making it up, and I got in and knit and helped him make the net up, see. And he was very considerate in showing me how to cut the net and all, cut the webbing out, and on those we were cutting them. Two-in-one cut and a four-in-one cut. That was the cuts we were using on the body of the net, was a four-in-one cut, and the wings of the net was two-in-one cuts. And, of course, the sewing together were just a steady, might be a monotonous thing for somebody to do, but with me it was just like a woman knitting her socks or a sweater or something like that. You know, it was a real pleasure to do it. I enjoyed it. So I kept on, and I was running out inlet harbor for most of the time that I was fishing, about 30 years. And the boys down there, they were buying nets around various places, you know, different types of nets. So the boys come down from North Carolina, and they were doing better with the balloon nets than we were doing with the flat nets, see, the type that Captain Anchor Damgard made for me. So I went over to New Smyrna and asked Johnny McDonald, which was a local fisherman here that made nets, that was his trade, and as well as shrimping too. And so he drew me a diagram how to make a balloon net, see. And he drew it out on the paper and gave me the amount of meshes that was supposed to be on it. But I made the mistake. He forgot to put down that the bottom corner was supposed to be 20 meshes or 30 meshes less than the top corner piece was. So I put a bit both the same size, and then I just cut back into the bottom of the net the 30 meshes. See, I thought that's what he meant. I cut back into the bottom of the net, but my chain line and my float line was the same length and hung the same, all except for that 30 meshes that I cut back into the net there. And it really didn't make that much difference anyway, because it's cut across the angle, and it did give it no extra webbing in the bottom of the net, see. So I went out the very first day that I took it out. The old Alice from New Smyrna come out, and he throwed his net over. Of course, all the boats were using single nets back then. They hadn't evolved into the twin net rigs or the four net rigs. And he came out, threw his net over, and made one drag, and cranked his boat up and went back to New Smyrna. The Lou out of New Smyrna, he came out, put his net over, made one drag, come right by me and dragged on inshore and to the south away, picked his net up, cranked up, and went back to New Smyrna. I picked up, pulled my first drag for an hour and a half, pulled it into the side of the boat, and man, I was loaded with fish. I had a terrific load of fish, but I also had about 60 or 75 pounds of shrimp in it, see? So I figured it was worth putting back over. I had my sister-in-law running the boat, and I was letting the nets out. See, I let the lines run off the caps and head and tied the net off, and she'd stop the boat, and I'd tie the net off, and then we'd go ahead and tow it for the hour and a half. Well, anyway, we had so much stuff we couldn't lift it. There wasn't no way I could lift it, so I just put a line around the outside the bag to hold it against the side of the boat and cut the net, ripped the net lengthwise down the bag and took my baler and bailed out 1,000 pounds of it so I could lift it over into this little boat that I had. Only had a 26-footer. It was the first boat that I shrimped with. There were only two of us out there with boats that size. One boat out in New Salon, a little boat like mine. And they were too small for that purpose, but we were doing it anyway because there's plenty of shrimp. We could catch them. So I remember that the boats that come out there that hadn't caught nothing, they turned around and went back, hadn't caught nothing but fish. So I went ahead and dragged and made the full day up until about 3:30 in the afternoon. I had so many fish piled up at the cockpit because we couldn't possibly go through all the stuff and get the shrimp out of it till the next drag would be coming up in an hour and a half, see? Or an hour and 15 minutes, we'd just be...